Hello, I'm Paul Scott. Today I'm talking to Mike Rabel, Chief Executive of Port Merion. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Paul.
Okay, so Port Merion is listed on AIM. Ticker is PMP. Market cap is about £56 million. Quick disclaimers, I'm not charging a fee for this, and I do hold shares in the company personally. Also, just to say, Mike, you did a very good webinar, I thought, recently on the Investor Meet Company platform. So I direct my listeners to that, and we can just do a Q&A rather than duplicate all the content on Investor Meet Company.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah.
It does. Good. So you stepped up to CEO from formerly you were CFO, I noticed, in September 2019. So you know that you already knew the business very well then.
Yes, I've been in the business for a couple of years as CFO, so that's great. That gives me a head start. I also had a lot of, you know, ideas about where I could take the business, and you know, this year's been great. My first year, it's been a challenging year with kind of backdrop of all the things that have happened, but it's been fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
Great. Probably before we go any further, could you describe Port Merion for any of the listeners who are not familiar with the group?
Yeah, of course. So Port Merion is a global homewares business. We sell to the consumer market. We have six brands that have between them over 700 years of combined history or heritage. A number of those brands are what we call ceramic tableware brands. That includes Spode, Royal Worcester, and Port Merion. But we also have brands like Wax Lyrical, which is the largest UK candle manufacturer. And more recently, we've acquired Nombe, which is a premium homewares, entertaining, and kitchenware brand. So six brands, lots of history, sold all around the world, and it's a great business, yeah.
Okay, and then you do quite a lot of your production in the UK, particularly of wax lyrical and the ceramics, don't you? Which I'm sure we can all agree is a great thing. So how many people are employed in the UK and where?
So that's right. In our UK, we have two UK factories, one in Stoke-on-Trent, the home of the Potteries, which makes a lot of our ceramic ware, and we have one up in the Lake District, Cumbria, that makes candles and reed diffusers under the Wax Lyrical brand. Those two factories together probably account for about 50% of what we sell globally around the world. And we have about 450 people employed in the two factories, maybe a little bit more, 450, 475 people in the two factories. In addition to that, there's obviously warehouses and office-based staff, but 450 in the factory.
Okay. And then your overseas production, am I right in thinking that's all made in China?
No, not necessarily. We do have one factory that makes exclusively frozen China, a very high-quality factory in Shenzhen, but we also make in other places in the Far East, including Thailand. We also make in Sri Lanka. And we're shortly going to be making a range in Portugal as well. So we're making in a number of different outsourced factories.
I was just going to say, they're not factories you operate, I take it. They're third-party suppliers, are they?
They're third-party suppliers. Normally, yeah. These are factories that we've worked with for many, many years and have a very good relationship with, but no, we don't own them.
Great. Okay. So do you have any plans to reshore more production to the UK, given the risk of possible trade tariffs or other restrictions on international trade?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting point, very interesting question, Paul. And, you know, we periodically do look at whether we can bring more production back into the UK. One of the reasons we don't make all of our ceramic ware in our UK factory is simply the capabilities we have in our UK factory don't extend to making certain products that have a body called porcelain, for example, fine by in China. So we tend to make those elsewhere, but we do look at it regularly, and you know, and we're looking at various things again right now. But and that would be great. You know, I'm very proud of the fact we've got UK factories, and the more we can make in the UK, the better. I mean, it's interesting as well, and that, you know, certainly in the last month or so, you know, increasingly we're getting inquiries from people that are really interested in that kind of made in the UK, made in England badge. Mm. And so, you know, I think that's perhaps a little bit of the fallout from the COVID thing. People value local production, local manufacturing, maybe more than they did a year ago. But it's an interesting trend.
Yeah, and I suppose the next obvious question leading on from that is what sort of risks and maybe opportunities do you see from Brexit?
Yeah, I mean, look, we've been working and planning on a de-risk Brexit for some years, as you'd expect. This is not something new. Overall, I don't think it's a massive risk for us. And, you know, generally speaking, there are two things we evaluate. One is a massive change in tariffs and duty rates. And secondly is, you know, short-term or medium-term disruption at ports. Mm. And in terms of the tariffs, you know, I don't think that's going to be a material impact on us. You know, there'll be ups and downs, certainly in terms of our key markets. I'm not overly concerned about that. Port disruption, you know, who knows if there is a, you know, almighty mess up and the ports can't cope with the volumes going in and out during January, then that is a problem. And all we really can do for that is make sure we're holding a little bit more stock in other places, well, within the UK and outside the UK, so that if there is short-term disruption, it isn't going to impact us too much. But generally speaking, I don't think it's a massive risk. And, you know, in terms of opportunities, we already sell in, I think, about 70 countries at last count. And, you know, part of our strategy is to grow and have some bigger markets outside the UK and the US. And so, you know, I'm not too concerned about Brexit hurting that ambition that we have. I think as long as you have a great product and, you know, you have people in either in the country or you work with distributors in those countries and you choose the right distributors and have the right marketing strategy, then I think it's very possible to expand around the world.
Yeah, well, that's reassuring. And then talking about your brands, I mean, you've got some amazing heritage brands, as you've mentioned. Do you think maybe they've got a little bit sleepy over the last few years?
Well, I think that's a good point. And one of the challenges of having six brands is, you know, you've got to be prepared to invest behind them all. You know, I'm a big believer in the marketing dollars. And I think increasingly with, you know, with online, the, you know, digital marketing and telling your story of your brand online is really important. So, yeah, I do think we've got some untapped potential. And, you know, particularly brands like Spode, I'm a huge fan of, Royal Worcester, I think we could do a lot more with them. I think we can leverage them harder. But also with brands we've acquired more recently, Wax Lyrical and Nombe, you know, part of our plan is to take those and do something with them to grow them, you know, from being UK and US centric respectively into more international brands. So I absolutely think we can do more. And, you know, that's what we're kind of figuring out right now is, you know, what's the marketing and brand story and, you know, where do we need to invest and how do we get to where we want to get to?
Yeah, because I wasn't familiar with Nombe, so I had a quick look at the website and I must say it's quite high end, isn't it? Mid to high end stuff. Very, very stylish, I thought. I've got my eye on that nice curved wooden fruit bowl, so I think if the shares double, I'll buy one of those to celebrate.
Yeah, it's beautiful product. Yeah, and we bought that business because it was very US-centric, didn't really have any international footprint. We figured that we could help with that. We liked the fact that it was a different design ethic and design style, and bringing that design skill set and some of the materials into the rest of the group, I thought could help with some of the other brands we've got. You talked about we've got heritage brands and keeping some of those heritage brands and some of the ranges actually have also sold for hundreds of years. Keeping them going is important, but I'm also very excited about how can we bring out some more contemporary and more gifting products under some of those brands. And so the Nombe style is definitely going to be part of that.
Yeah, is there much, just an idea that's popped into my head, with these different brands, do you have much sort of, do the brand, people within each brand get to know the people in the other brands and bounce ideas and best practice around? Is there much, or are they largely autonomous?
Yeah, so Wax Lyrical is slightly different because it's a very different product. Candles and reed diffusers are a very different product. But we're actually, you know, bringing them much into a closer orbit with the ceramic management teams. And Nombe, we've already integrated that completely into our existing US ceramic business. So actually now if you go into our US office, it really is one team and one salesperson for a particular area will be going out with both brands. So those two businesses are integrated. So I think very much it needs to be one pool of people, one pool of talent from a design point of view, from a brand and marketing point of view, from an online point of view. And also, you know, traditional wholesale trade customer point of view as well.
Yeah, and I suppose with everybody using Zoom these days so much, have you found that that's facilitated the interaction between all the people?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a very odd period, isn't it, for everybody, I think.
Yeah.
I think we've all learned a huge amount about our businesses that we probably would have taken a lot longer to learn, and, you know, if this hadn't happened. And that's, I guess, the one positive out of all this. You know, I feel that we understand our business so much better. And certainly we've all discovered how to be productive without traveling, you know, and meeting up face to face. You know, I think there are some downsides from that, and that, you know, initiating new projects, that kind of face to face stuff, there's still a lot of value from that. But certainly we managed to keep the business going very successfully and, you know, save a lot of time traveling, I guess, which has been invested in more productive things. But in terms of, does it help us work together? You know, one of the things that I've tried to do in my first year is build out more global teams and global processes. And having worked in some kind of much bigger businesses in the past, I think those global teams and global processes really mean that everybody gets pulled forward together, and you don't get pockets of people or a brand or whatever that gets left behind. So I am very passionate about trying to create ways that people can be interfacing globally, you know, regular meetings and calls and work processes, so that we go forward as one global team.
Yeah, sounds really good. I'm jumping about a bit here with these questions, but one reader asked about the bad debt risk from your customers, which I suppose would be the distributors, wouldn't it, rather than retailers? Or do you sell to retailers direct as well?
We sell to retailers direct, particularly in our core UK and US markets, and together they account for maybe 65% of our total sales. So we do sell direct to retailers, direct to distributors in export markets, and increasingly direct to the consumer through online channels.
So what about the bad debt risk then from a lot of retailers at the moment seem to be sort of staggering on but might end up going bust? I mean, is there a bad debt risk there, and do you use credit insurance over the customer receivables?
I mean, I think credit risk is always something you have to watch very carefully, and as the risk and the volatility goes up, and this is certainly one of those kind of years, then clearly the credit risk goes up as well. And in terms of how that impacts us, we're pretty cautious in terms of trading terms and credit limits. And, you know, an example of that would be, you know, in the US in kind of March when COVID really hit in the US and retailers started to shut bricks and mortar down and whatever, you know, we had, you know, a number of, you know, I'd probably call them second tier retail customers, you know, not our, some of our biggest customers, but, you know, they, when they started asking for extended terms, we just said, well, look, for now, we'd rather not trade with you. You know, we understand how difficult it is. Love to trade you again in the future, but we don't want to be, you know, trading with you on 180 days or whatever, because it's just not, it's just too risky for us. So, you know, actually we've fared very, very well so far, touch wood. In terms of our export markets, I think 90% of our export markets are, you know, and you use the word credit insured, we do credit insure them. So, you know, we have very little risk in terms of export, but we just have to manage carefully within the UK, US. You have to be sensible. You know, a sale isn't really a sale until you've collected the debt.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So
just as a general point of interest, really, have you found that credit insurance has got a lot more expensive, or that they remove limits or you remove facilities for particular customers?
We've not had a massive problem with that yet.
Right.
Having said that, I think, you know, we're on, you know, often annual, biannual renewal terms, so with credit insurance policies, so we may not have hit those renewal dates yet. But we have, you know, it's over a basket of customers, basket of countries, and that tends to mean you get a good average rate.
Yeah, okay. That all sounds buttoned up. This is a nice thing when you have a CEO who used to be the CFO. You know the financial controls are going to be good.
Yeah, no excuses for not knowing the numbers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Just looking at Christmas 2020 then, I know you've got a key product line. It's almost like an annuity, I was told by the former CEO, this Christmas tree range, which sells very strongly in America, doesn't it? So you're fairly heavily reliant on the H2, particularly Christmas trading period. So are the orders coming in as normal or at reduced quantities at the moment?
Yeah, so I think the range you're referring to is Spode Christmas tree, and you're right. It's something that was created in the 1920s and has sold, I guess, you know, pretty much for nearly 100 years since. It does kind of $8 to $10 million every year. And so, you know, I guess in that respect, it is a bit like an annuity. What we do is we try and refresh it each year, bring out some new kind of collectible pieces. But it does very well, particularly strong in the US and strong from sort of like October through December. So, you know, we've manufactured stock for a successful Christmas. You know, so far, you know, I'm limited in terms of what I can say about, you know, trading right now, having just done our kind of interim results, but, you know, I'm comfortable with the orders and the orders intent we have. But, you know, in this year, more than any other year, as we've all found out, retailers can cancel orders at 24 hours notice, which is what happened in March with all the COVID lockdowns. So, you know, we're comfortable with where we are now. I'm pleased with what we can see, but it's the Christmas season that I'm sure is going to have all kinds of surprises to throw at all of us. So, it's, you know, we're a little bit wary on that front.
Yeah. Okay. And I think you said in the Investor Meet Company webinar that, I mean, I know you can't give forecasts, but you were saying that really, well, no, I think you said in the RNS you're expecting a profit in the second half, weren't you? And the first half was only a small loss. So this year as a whole, I'm kind of looking at as a bit of a, not a write-off, but really a year to just forget and move on. And then I think you said you saw hopefully a fairly reasonable recovery for 2021. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think the kind of guidance and forecast that the analysts that cover us have put out in the last week or so are in line with that. They're kind of saying, you know, we're expecting to make a profit in the second half and, you know, therefore make a marginal profit in the full year. You know, the only rise to that is if there's a huge retail shutdown again where everything gets shut down, then, you know, we might have to relook at that. But I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think that's going to happen. So that's this year. And next year, yeah, I mean, again, the guidance that is out there is that we broadly get back to where we were in 2019. And that's really a combination of things, I think. I think it's, you know, we're still assuming that it's going to be a COVID kind of headache or hangover next year, you know, and we're kind of assuming it's still probably roughly a 10% drag on where we were before the crisis. But I think we're going to more than offset that, or at least offset that by the benefit of the initiatives we're working on to grow the business and investments we're making. So we think that 21 will be roughly in line with 2019. And then beyond that, you know, I think the guidance again out there is that when we start getting into a good year-on-year growth, double-digit growth, and improvements in operating margin and therefore profit as well. You know, and I think the key thing to say is that we've continued to invest or increase investment during this COVID year behind our strategy. And I think that's really important because, you know, we haven't got the benefits aren't in the numbers yet because of all the, you know, the COVID disruption, but we will get the benefit from that. And I think, you know, you have a choice, you know, when February, March this year, you get a choice about whether you kind of shut everything down and put your head in the sand and wait for the storm to pass, or whether you look at how, you know, you come out of this stronger. And we've definitely carried on investing, actually increasing investment, hiring in key areas. And you know, I'm pleased that we've done that because I think it will pay off.
Yeah, no, that's good. And I noticed that obviously you did the placing as well, because that's how I originally got involved on a very small scale. I liked your presentation you did about the strategy, the growth strategy. So I took a few shares in the placing personally, and I bought some more since. So your balance sheet's absolutely, I would say, pretty much bulletproof now, isn't it? So
yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I wanted to do the equity raise, the fundraise, even though it was a diluted price, because, again, to my previous point, I think that having the confidence through this COVID year to actually increase investment and try and accelerate things, you know, requires requires money, you know, and although we had, you know, good headroom with our current facilities, I thought that bringing in additional funds just meant that we could really accelerate and invest with confidence and still have great contingency in our headroom for whatever the rest of this COVID thing has to throw at us. So, you know, I'm really pleased we did it, and we brought on board a lot of new institutional shareholders. So we've got, you know, a very different mix of shareholders now, and that's great. I'm really, really pleased.
Yeah, okay. And, I mean, the only other thing I would mention is which isn't on the agenda, it just popped into my head, was about the liquidity of the shares. Does the market liquidity is very poor. Even to buy a few thousand shares can sometimes really be a struggle in a wide market spread. Do you think the bringing in more shareholders in the placing might help that? And what other things might you consider to improve market liquidity in the shares?
Yeah, I know that has been an issue at times. You know, I think by issuing more shares, you know, roughly 25%, that has to help liquidity. You know, we have, you know, and we're very fortunate to have a lot of people that are long-term holders. But yeah, as you say, you do need regular volumes going through the market. I think the other thing, sorry, so I think, you know, additional shares being issued, which we've done, will help. But the other thing, you know, which I'm really passionate about is trying to talk to more people, not just the kind of institutional people that you meet every 6 months on a roadshow in the City of London. So, you know, whether it's Investor Meets Company, that portal, or you know, talking to you, or going maybe doing some retail investor conferences, I think just being able to talk to the retail investor a little bit more, explain the vision and ambition that I have for the business and what we're going to do to get there, I think that hopefully will free up some liquidity as well.
Yeah, that's great. And I think I'm certainly not alone in saying how much I appreciate and enjoy the webinar presentations that you and loads of other companies have started doing in the last year. It's such an efficient use of time, just being able to log in rather than having to, you know, spend the whole day traveling in and out of London. So I love it. So keep them coming.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's, let's see where that technology goes. But I think we were one of the first to do it in March when they launched. I think we had like 12 or 13 people, which you think, well, okay, that's not a lot. I think this time last week we maybe had 30 something. So if it keeps growing like that, then, you know, you get 60, 70 next time. And I think it's, as you say, it's an efficient use of time, but also it's people that you don't normally get the chance to talk direct to. So
I think the other thing on that, though, is a lot of people look at the recording after the event. I know I often do. So it will be interesting to get the stats maybe a month after the webinar and see how many watch the recording. And I bet you it will be a few hundred.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Now, one of my blog readers from Stockopedia, who's called Sheriff JEB, I don't know what that stands for, but he says, he's asking about CapEx. He says you mentioned in the webinar that you were going to automate certain processes to improve your production margins. So he's asking, what type of machinery would that be? And do you have a target return on investment or payback period for CapEx?
Yeah, well, I think what I said in the webinar was I was reflecting on the fact that I wanted to get our manufacturing cost per unit down by at least 10%, and, you know, reflecting that perhaps we hadn't invested as much in the last 5 years in our factories, particularly our Stoke factory, as we might have done. Working with a third party automation company, actually based in Manchester, gives us a very fresh perspective, and I think that's important, particularly in the pottery industry, where there's people that spend their whole life and their children follow them, you know, and work within one industry. I think bringing people from outside in is challenging but good. And so in terms of the exact nature of the machines, it will be many different things over the next 3 years. I think there are three that I've highlighted in this particular roadshow that we've done the last couple of months. One is in build right now, and that's something called a heat release machine. And what that does is a lot of our products is heavily patterned or decorated, and there are a number of ways you can apply that piece of art and image to the product. And without going into too much detail, you know, sometimes we have to have, you know, we have about 70 people who, you know, are incredibly skilled at hand applying the image or the images to the product. and sometimes it goes through a slightly more automated process and machines are involved. Again, it's still the hand-drawn artwork that's then reproduced, so it's still that artwork, that lithograph or decal, but it can be more automated. And so, you know, the biggest build we've got going on is a brand new machine that will apply the decals to a lot of our products. The existing machine is 20 years old, and that new machine has a substantial increase in throughput or output per 8-hour shift, and you know, a lot lower cost. So it's a kind of a win-win. You know, the other examples that I flagged in the webinar were, you know, again, a piece of automation that allows us to apply the decal to mugs, certain mugs, automatically, and cut up the sheets of all the images, all the artwork into bite-sized chunks. So again, it's just ways of getting more efficient. But it'll be different. It'll be different machines in different parts of the factory, and indeed in our wax lyrical factory as well. But the intention is just to get a lot more efficient, a lot more flexible, a lot lower cost per unit, which will drive our margins.
So in terms of payback period then on that type of equipment or return on investment, what do you have a benchmark figure that you have to prove that it beats that before you invest?
Yeah, I don't have a hard rule on that, you know, and all of those kind of sizable projects, as you'd expect, we produce a formal CapEx that goes to the board and everyone gets a chance to ask questions and then it gets approved or not approved. But, you know, typically for me, I like projects that pay back in 3 years or better. And in fact, those three I described have an average payback of around 2 years. So,
gosh, you know, on a no-brainer.
I think it's a no-brainer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find as well, just as an aside, going back to my days when I was in FD in clothing retail, and people used to bring me ideas for spending money for a particular project or whatever, and I used to find that the payback calculations were very often wildly optimistic or completely fictitious. I mean, do you measure after the event to see if a bit of CapEx you've done has matched the payback you expected?
Well, we do. Sometimes, and clearly you've experienced this, Paul, sometimes it's not as easy as you think to do that post-analysis. But, you know, we do try and do that, particularly for major projects and projects with paybacks. You know, and sometimes things do genuinely change, which means that you don't make a payback. But I think the important thing is to make sure, you know, regularly that the change you've put in stays in place, and that, you know, it's not like a rubber band where you stretch it and then 2 months later or 3 years later you've kind of gone back to the original shape. So we would routinely come back and review CapExes.
Yeah, okay. So moving on next then to online sales. I know this is a big focus of yours, and it's the area that probably interests me the most in terms of me wanting to buy shares in this, because I've done pretty well on several other shares recently, like Boohoo and an online supercar competition company called Best of the Best. And in both cases, it was really cracking digital marketing that was the key catalyst to making those such successful investments, hence why I sort of got interested in you. So could you talk to us a bit more then about your focus on growing online sales?
Well, yeah, it's certainly a central part of the new strategy we have. I think it's a big opportunity for us. And, you know, in a nutshell, you know, we have, you know, our six brands, you know, a number of them have been around, as we said, for hundreds of years, and some of the product ranges have been on sale for hundreds of years. And, you know, there are clearly, when I ask in markets, millions and millions of people that own that product or that brand around the world. But when I asked, you know, well, how many of those customers do we actually have on our database, you know, an email address, or, you know, how can we reach out and touch them and talk to them? And then, you know, if I go back to December 18, I think the answer I got was like, well, it's like 50,000 around the world. It's like, well, hang on a minute. You know, there's millions and millions of people that have our products. And we know that when people buy some of our products, they often want to buy again, repeat purchase. But we've only got 50,000 names. And yeah, that was basically the answer. And so that's why I think it's important. I think that, and then I don't mind whether we sell direct off one of our own websites or through a retailer website necessarily. What's important is that we're telling the story far more effectively than we have done about our brands, what they stand for, the quality of the products, how they were designed, what they do, and all that kind of stuff. And that's going to be an investment. And we started on that journey, and we're making progress, but we're a long way, I think, from, you know, you gave a couple of example companies there, you know, we're a long way from where we know we need to get to. But the initial payback or progress we're seeing is great. It reinforces that I think it's the right thing to do. And I think the payback when we get there in the next couple of years will be fantastic. It's going to be, you know, we're spending more money on marketing. We've hired new marketing teams, much more digitally savvy. We're building new website platforms. We're retaking all of our photography for all of our products, which is a huge exercise. We're building a new digital asset management system, which enables us to push all those content out to all the retailers for their websites and our own websites. So there's a number of pieces in the jigsaw that we have to get right. And, you know, that's before we even get into kind of customer acquisition strategies, you know, and we're doing things on that as well. You know, we just filmed our first TV advert, and it's a direct-to-consumer TV advert, and that's going to start in the US in just in a couple of days' time. So, again, trying to bring people into our brands, into our products in different ways. So I'm really excited about online. I think it's the most important thing we've got on our plate. It's getting the most investment. We've hired, you know, almost a new marketing team in various parts of the business through this year. We've got another four or five people starting through this month in October. So we're going to be in a very different capability space, I think, at the end of this year. And it always starts with people, as you all know, Paul. Get the right people in, bring fresh people in, give them time to take you on that journey. So, yeah, I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, as part of my research process for the shares, I bought one of your sets of Botanic Garden plates and bowls and so on in a special offer, and was absolutely delighted, you know, well-packaged, beautiful product, very high quality, excellent courier, you know, all really, really good experience. And I've already reordered some additional pieces. So because a lot of these product ranges are collectibles, it seems tailor-made for online, doesn't it? Because you can build a relationship with that customer who will then repeat order direct with you. So it makes a lot of sense, I think.
I think so. And as long as we give, you know, as long as the product is great and people get it and it's great, then you've got a very good chance of having a repeat customer. But, you know, we're not where we need to be. And, you know, I would imagine that it probably took 3 to 5 days for your order to come. And, you know, what I wanted to do is I wanted to come tomorrow. Yeah. And, you know, we, at the moment on some of our websites, we are gradually improving. But sometimes, you know, we present 3,000 or 4,000 SKUs to an online customer, which is confusing. You know, we kind of laid it out the way we manage our business rather than the way the consumer actually wants to shop. And, you know, one of the big things we see, you know, through this COVID year, as people have been more and more online shopping, is you've got to make it easy for someone to get what they want. And sometimes people just want to have a set that is pre-made for them. Here is a set where you get, you know, six of this, one click, boom, into checkout. And, you know, that's what we've got to engineer into our own website interfaces.
Yeah, okay. So obviously there will have been an online boom during lockdown, I'm guessing. So what proportion of sales are online now, and what's the target longer term?
Well, so let me first of all address our own website sales rather than all online sales. But for our own website sales in 2018, they were just 4%. Of our total. In 2019, they were 6%, so a little bit higher, but, you know, not massively moving the dial. In the first half of this year, they were 15%, albeit aided by the massive change in consumer behavior because retailers were shut for 2 or 3 months. You know, when we laid the strategy out in quarter four last year, our target was to be at least 15% for our own website sales. So, you know, in a way, we kind of did that in half one. I think there's more to go. And we've got to retain that business, obviously, with retail reopening. And in terms of, you know, let me call it all channel, online channels, which would include retailer websites and pure play websites like Amazon and Wayfair. I think in 2019, in the UK and the US, we'd actually got to 30% going through all online channels. And we said, you know, we wanted to get beyond 50%. And in 2020, half one, I think we were mid-40s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're making progress, you know, but it would be wrong to say that everything that's happened in the first 7, 8, 9 months of this year is because of things we've done. You know, a lot of it is because of the retail shutdowns. And the important thing is that we continue to invest. Now we know what's possible. So, but it's a very different kind of model, very different kind of marketing. And, you know, some of the traditional spends that we probably had for tens and tens of years, you know, huge trade shows in different parts of the world that actually cost a lot of money to put on and do, you know, I think those kind of spends increasingly need to be converted into actually telling the story of your brands in online space to the end consumer in a more effective way.
Do you have, I know in fashion they have a lot of vloggers and social influencers. Is that something that takes place with ceramics and candles? I don't know.
Well, I think it is, but it's an area really that we haven't done a lot of. We started doing that in the last 6 months in the UK with some kind of, you know, as you call them, vloggers or influencers, just in a little bit, and we're certainly going to do a lot more. But actually, for our own websites, actually a vast amount of the traffic and sales we get is actually what I would call organic. So it's people that just want, know what they want, come to us.
Yeah.
And so actually there is a big opportunity for us to get traffic from the social media platforms, from social and paid search as well. People that maybe are looking for a set of mugs rather than a Botanic Garden or Spode product. So we've got that avenue to really open up, I think, in the next year or so.
Yeah, okay. And looking at online margins, I mean, with my FD hat on, I'm assuming that the margins would be good because you're not only making the manufacturer's margin, the wholesaler's or distributor's margin and the retailer's margin all in one. So is that, am I getting overexcited on that or is that accurate?
No, I think your FD has been very valuable in informing that. I mean, if it's going through a retailer website, you know, whether it's johnlewis.co.uk or Amazon or Macy's.com in the US, then, you know, typically the margins will be equivalent to what they are for bricks and mortar.
Yeah.
But through our own websites, then yes, absolutely, there is, you know, maybe a 15% gross margin, accretive gross margin for selling it ourselves. You know, you have a slightly higher cost of fulfillment in the warehouses, but you're still going to be at least 10 points clear, I think,
additional
warehousing costs. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, excellent. And just also for clearance deals on overstocked or seconds, is online a good way of reducing surplus inventories?
It is, and indeed we did some of that in kind of end of March, beginning of April, when things were a lot more uncertain than perhaps they are now, particularly in the UK. And we do produce seconds. You know, part of the pottery ceramic manufacturing process does produce a certain percentage of seconds, and so, you know, one of the ways we get rid of those, sell those, because they are near perfect, really. You know, we call them seconds, but it doesn't really do them justice. Is we have a number of outlet stores around the UK where we sell them, but obviously they were shut. So we do sell them online. I think what's important is we need to segregate the seconds and clearance products from, you know, the brand new or the new launches and whatever else. But that's something under our control on our website. The other thing that, you know, we've just built is a B2B site and platform starting in the UK. And I think that's a good opportunity as well, is if you have run out lines or excess, you know, we can put certain offers onto that B2B website going forward. And I think that could be quite an effective route to clear as well.
Yeah, great. Next question, just obviously we've covered digital marketing really before. So I'll jump to the next question on freehold property. I think I'm right in saying you've got a big freehold site in Stoke. Is that right?
We've actually got two freehold sites in Stoke. Yeah, one factory with offices and one warehouse site. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, that's an important advantage in lowering costs over the long term, isn't it? So I mean, I'm not a fan of these people who talk about having efficient balance sheets. I'd rather have a balance sheet with lots of cash and lots of freeholds in it. I mean, are you similarly minded?
Well, yeah, you and I, we might be contrarians on that, because a lot of people, you know, have done sale and lease backs and stuff and, you know, gear. But yeah, I'm kind of with you. I think it's, if it's a long-term site, it makes sense to own it, as long as you're not tying up capital that you can make a better return on in another part of the business. But for us, the land and the buildings, both for the factories and the offices and the warehouses, and certainly in Stoke-on-Trent, we own all that. So,
How many acres is it, and how much is that worth, do you reckon?
I'll be honest, I'm not even going to guess. I'm sorry, I don't know how many acres it is or what it's worth. It's recorded a book value, I think, in our balance sheet. But in terms of what the market value is, I'm not an expert in that area, and I don't think we'll have had a valuation done recently. Okay. But it's good to have own what you have. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Just another balance sheet question then on the most recent interims. I thought that the inventories figure of 30.6 million looked a bit high. I'm just wondering, do we have a stock overhang there?
I think, to be honest, it is higher than I would like, and I think we can get more efficient. It was boosted at that particular snapshot, June 2020. It was boosted by a number of reasons, including, you know, an acquisition and moving into hand sanitizer. But it was also, you know, higher because a lot of the ranges that we designed for new launch and then produced didn't really get to launch properly in what I call the spring-summer season. You know, just as they were about to ship, kind of second half of March, April, the world changed, retailers shut down, cancelled everything. So we did carry more stock for new lines and new developments. But that started to sell through, and, you know, it's not perfect, but it's not going to go out of fashion, so to speak. It's not a product that deteriorates with time. Mm. So, you know, but I think in other areas, I think, you know, we have to be careful when we're launching new products that we're also discontinuing product and ranges as well. And I think there's increased efficiency we can get in terms of just being a little bit tighter with our SKU count.
Yeah, okay. And the other, following on from that, I'm just wondering, is there scope to move towards a more just-in-time type of production cycle once the whole COVID thing settled down?
I think for our UK factories, that's a possibility. However, again, it's an industry, certainly at the moment for us, it's an industry where long production runs have a value in terms of, you know, the cost of that production run rather than doing lots of changes. So it does make sense to have a long production run. And if we're going to manufacture something for a new range, kind of making, you know, certainly a lot more than 1 month sales, making 6 month sales in one go, you know, has an efficiency benefit. For the product, about half of what we sell, Paul, is actually made in third-party factories, and then we're bound again by, again, minimum order quantities in terms of their production efficiency, but also the length of time it takes to get from a factory somewhere around the world into the sales market, which, you know, can be 6 weeks of transport time. So again, that does lead you to slightly more inefficient kind of inventory process.
Yeah. Okay. So if you try to make it too efficient, you'd end up losing sales, wouldn't you? I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I think there would be a cost from being too efficient, but I do think we can do better for sure. And I think we had too much stock at the half year. We're working through it now, and over the next couple of years, we need to get tighter in certain areas.
Great, thanks for that. And then another reader question here from Jeremy. He says, "I like to invest in companies where management hold a big percentage of the equity. Executives at Paul Merriam seem to have very small shareholdings. How can you better align your interests with those of shareholders?"
Yeah, I mean, look, I understand Jeremy's sentiment. I think we've had a big change in the makeup of our board in the last 12 months. And so if you went back 12 months ago, then I think some of the directors that are now left or retired had much more significant shareholdings, including the chief executive that retired last year, Lawrence Bryan. I think, so I agree with the sentiment. I think the new management team needs some time to build up their stakes, but are very aware of wanting to align with shareholders. You know, I could speak, I can speak personally for myself. You know, I'm at a stage in life where I've got three kids school age, and, you know, what I can invest, you know, is what I can invest, and hopefully it's going to be more, and hopefully we're going to build up stakes. But we've got a younger management team and a very new management team compared to where we were 12 months ago. So, yeah, I think give it time.
Okay, no, it's a good answer, thank you. Now, just to touch on your other growth plans, I know you've done something in Canada and you're looking at other new markets. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, I mean, with regard to Canada, we were in for many years, 20, 25 years, in a joint venture with another company for the Canadian market. And I think that's worked well to a degree, but I think it's probably got a little bit tired in the last 5 years. And I think we can do a lot more in Canada when I look at the population size, consumer population size, proximity in terms of taste to the US and indeed the UK. And so we had the opportunity to buy that joint venture out, take full control, which is what we did in August this year. And, you know, we're integrating the team in Canada and Toronto into our existing US team in New Jersey right now. And I think there's going to be, you know, good opportunities to kind of revitalize that market. It's never going to be as big as the US or the UK or even South Korea, I don't think, but I think it can do a lot more than what it's doing now. In terms of other markets, you know, in terms of trying to be more focused in our strategy, you know, I've said to our commercial teams that I would much rather we, in 3 to 5 years, have another three big markets around the world than us try and incrementally grow 70 markets. And it's certainly not that I don't value the other 70 markets, I do, but I think that being more laser focused and saying, right, what do we have to do to have a significant market in, for example, China or in the Middle East or in Germany? Let's make sure we have the right people, that we invest the right amount of money in those markets. I think that will pay off because, you know, right now when we review our business, we talk about the UK, the US and South Korea, and then we've got another 67 countries that do, you know, a small amount. You know, it would be great if I could talk about six big markets, for example, in a couple of years' time.
Mm. Yeah, and Japan and Germany must be quite big potential markets, I'd imagine, aren't they?
Yeah, Japan, we do a reasonable amount of business in Germany, a reasonable amount of business, but I think, you know, not enough that we're actually then talking about it in reviews and presentations, and I think they could be much bigger. And so having the right partners, distributors, maybe having people on the ground. In China, we're opening up distributors and online distributors right now and actually having, you know, some representation on the ground, which I think is a more effective way of doing it. So I think we have an opportunity to really grow that export business.
Yeah, great. Just one last question on the balance sheet as well. I know we touched on the placing earlier that you've now, effectively with hindsight, you didn't really need to do the placing, but you explained obviously that you wanted the safety really of having like an insurance policy almost. So will you be using some of that surplus cash for more acquisitions, or is it better to focus on the turnaround and growth strategies of the existing businesses?
Yeah, well, I mean, to be clear, the equity raise was about investing behind our strategy, our new strategy, our new vision for the business. And so, you know, that money is still going to be spent in that way. And it just means we've got more confidence and we're able to spend that money and still have a lot of headroom. But in terms of use of cash and future acquisitions, you know, I think the first thing I would say is that we've actually got six great brands, and I think we can work those brands, leverage those brands much, much harder. And I talked earlier about Spode and Royal Worcester as two examples, and you know, of brands we've had for a long time that I think are underweight. But owning a brand costs money. You've got to be prepared to spend money on it from a marketing point of view, spend money on it from a product development point of view. And so I really like to make more of, you know, my main priority is to make more of what we've already got, first and foremost. If there is, you know, something that comes up from an acquisition point of view that is that accelerates part of our strategy, then absolutely we consider it. But first and second priority is to make a lot more of what we've already got in the group.
Yeah, I can see the sense in that. Yeah, okay. I think that's pretty much covered everything. Are there any closing remarks you'd like to make, or key points that you want to mention that we've not covered?
Well, look, only really to say, firstly, thank you, Paul. Thank you for the invitation to do to have this conversation today. I've enjoyed it. It's great to get an opportunity to talk about the business. I believe that there's a really strong. We've got a really strong vision for where we can take this business and these brands. You know, we're very ambitious what we can do. And, you know, it's about growing the top line and growing the operating margin, therefore the profit, consistently delivering returns to our shareholders. I'm delighted that we've been able to navigate COVID relatively safely so far, you know, keeping our people safe, getting them back to work. But particularly I'm pleased that we've been able to really continue and increase investment in certain areas. I think that's going to pay back once the fogs of COVID finally clear. So it's been great to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you.
We're
very positive about the medium term future for our business, and be great to come back and update you sometime in the future.
Smashing. Excellent. Well, that's really good. Thanks ever so much, Mike. I've enjoyed it too. And thanks very much indeed for taking the time to speak to me.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Paul.
Righto. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.